Well, hello everyone. I am Billy Dees, and I'm here today for HO Press, Shorehouse Books, HumorOutcast.com. That is the place to take a humor break. On the Skype line with me is Arlene Schindler, author of Stand Up and Heartbreak, A Comic and Sex Addict Walk into a Marriage. What could go wrong, right? How are you doing today, Arlene?
I'm great, thank you.
All right. Now, you are originally, correct me if I'm wrong, but you are originally from Brooklyn.
Yes, but I grew up in Brooklyn in the gritty era.
Oh.
Before it became a hipster haven. One of my friends used to say that we grew up in a neighborhood that was so tough, murder was just a warning.
A warning. That's good. So this was like before the Starbucks and all that stuff going on.
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. Yes.
Now, you talked a little bit about what the neighborhood was like. What were your early days like? Were you like popular in school, or were you like the class clown, or what?
Well, I was the class clown, but I was also the chubby girl.
Oh.
So I was kind of not noticed.
Oh.
Or I was noticed by the losers and the people who were the honor students.
Oh, well, you know, sometimes they're the ones that change the world, though. You know, but
yes.
you don't know that at the time. Right.
Yeah.
Did you always aspire to be a comedian, or was that something that came along later in life?
Well, I came from a funny family, and my dad had been a comedian in his 20s. So in a way, it was kind of like going into the family business.
Oh, sure. Sure. Other than comedy, did you have any? Now, obviously, your dad was a comedian, so that's kind of where you got channeled because you were around it. You were in that environment. But was there any part of you that said, I want to be a veterinarian?
Well, I actually went to school to be a clothing designer.
Oh.
Yeah, on the other side of my family, my mother's father had been a clothing designer. He had been a haberdasher, and my mother and my aunt worked in fashion, so there was a lot of that in my background, and it kind of was a struggle for me.
Oh.
At one point.
Comedy was really hot in the 1980s. Back in those days, was like today we have this PC correctness type thing, political correctness. And one of my little theories, I have a lot of them, but one of my little theories is that one of the reasons why the ideological extremes always want to shut the other side down by saying that's bad, you shouldn't say that, is because humor is kind of a good way to sneak into someone's psyche. If I can make you laugh about something, you've considered it in a way that you might not have if I had been in your face. And I kind of feel that's something that is recognized now, and that's why people try to shut down humor. Was it easier back then? Could you get away with more? What's your take on that?
Well, I started in comedy in 1981, so it was the beginning of the 80s.
Okay.
And it was 5 minutes after disco.
Okay.
So comedy in a club as a club offering was so new that there were no rules.
Oh.
Because it was so new. And all of these clubs needed to fill their room. All these clubs that had disco.
Right.
So they brought in comedians because there was no instruments to set up and their audiences bought a lot of drinks.
Sure.
So trading a disco ball for a microphone, there was suddenly a ton of places and everybody was just, it was a wonderful time because in some ways it was a pioneering time.
Sure.
Yeah. But also, I mean, I think for myself as a writer using comedy, I did a book a while ago called The Last Place She'd Look. And in it, I felt that my readers were drawn into a story in one of two ways, that they were either shocked or seduced, which I think are big characteristics of comedy as well.
Oh, sure.
And And that in that book, if they were shocked or surprised about how a seduction unfolds, but then to the point of laughter.
Yes.
And in that book, there was a seductive dinner culminating with a romantic interlude in front of a roaring fire. And it ended with a clumsy mishap that practically set the house ablaze. So that's sort of my writing style, and that's sort of my approach, that I take a lot of very serious things and just kind of spin them, and that things that are really kind of terrible kind of go in a very funny, humorous direction.
Yeah, that's evident in your book, and we're going to get to that. I just have one more question, because you've mentioned it in various things that I've run across online. You mentioned that men are often the gatekeepers of the clubs. And I'm guessing that was certainly the case back in the 80s. Has it gotten any better?
It really hasn't gotten a lot better.
Really?
The only thing that's different now is that more shows are booked by women. But then they become all female showcases. So then it becomes a whole other thing. But men and women as being equal in comedy is still challenging. A lot of men in real life say they want to be with a woman who has a sense of humor. Yeah. But what they really mean is they want to be with a woman who will laugh at their jokes, not have bigger, better, and funnier jokes. So just, you know, take that to the workplace, and that's the climate.
I understand that, and I get that, and I believe it. Okay. I don't question that at all. You did mention in your book that you feel that being attractive sometimes can work against you in comedy. And I suppose that's true, you know, certainly for women, but I'm going to say it's kind of true for men too. I don't really recall too many comedians that are like Brad Pitt. I mean, there's just no, there just isn't. I, you know, it's kind of like me. I have a face for radio, so maybe I belong on stage doing that kind of stuff. Now, your book, I'm going to say the title here again, Stand Up and Heartbreak, A Comic and Sex Addict Walked Into a Marriage. Walk into a marriage. Kind of like a little send-up of the old, you know, joke, two guys walk into a bar type thing. Now, it's a memoir. And as we talked about, it has laughs, but it also has many serious undertones. So if you were to just briefly describe the book, you know, you'd hand it to somebody and say, hey, check this out. It's a blank. Well, how would you categorize it?
Well, it's bittersweet. Also, it's a comic and a sex addict. So it's two different people. The comic is not the sex addict.
Right.
The comic is the partner of the sex addict. So it's bittersweet. And readers have said that there's laughter and tears in the book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've gotten that already. Sure. I often hear that writing in general, but I would say it applies more to comedic writing, that it can be very therapeutic regarding what someone may have been through in their life. Was this the case for you, overcoming some of your, you know, your emotional ups and downs that occurred in your, in the instances that you describe in your book?
Yeah. Well, I think there was a time where I really needed to kind of rid myself of a lot of negative emotions, and I was able to write through my way to a better place with this. And I'm hoping in the future I might be able to help other people, possibly using workshops and journaling classes to help them move past being the partner of an addict and the frustrations and the emotional upheaval of it.
Sure. Okay, I'm gonna kind of go out on a limb here and say you have a lot of experience in relationships, and sometimes the idiosyncrasies that can come from them, you know, judging from your book and your memoir. So I'm going to ask you some questions here. How would you cope? What would be your advice for coping with a partner's addiction without losing your self-esteem? And I'm going to say for women that's more difficult, because women have a tendency to say, it's my fault.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I believe that when when someone is the partner of an addict, they feel an incredible sense of responsibility and a feeling of aloneness.
Yeah.
So I'd recommend that they talk to other people, either one-on-one or in a support group.
Okay. Okay, now here's an interesting one. What are the signs that you will have a short marriage?
Okay, feels like we're on a game show.
Yes.
I'd say a lot of it has to do with a lack of honesty and avoidance. One of my favorites was my partner was disappearing for hours at a time.
Oh.
And could not say or remember where I was out. I was out. What were you doing? Things. I had errands. Two states away. And also that money was disappearing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in 1982, what did you do to spend $100 on your lunch hour?
Yeah.
Even in the fanciest restaurants today, sandwiches cost a little bit less than that.
Yes. Now, your book obviously talks about sex addiction. How does sexual addiction impact a relationship? And if I may be a little coy here, the old adage, you know, great in bed, but hell to live with, is it kind of like that?
Well, one of the problems with being married to a sex addict is, that they can't mate in captivity.
Oh.
which means that when you were single, you were hot and desirable.
Yes.
But now that you're married to them, they don't want to touch you. They have sex with anyone but you.
Yeah.
So that's what the life becomes. So you don't know where they are and you don't know what they're doing, but you know what they're not doing with you.
Yeah. You mentioned that in your book. When the interest falls off, and I'll say the sexual interest, so people know what we're talking about. Is that another red flag when somebody's real hot for you one minute? And it's a different thing when people are over time, naturally, if you're married a long time and everybody, all right, you know, it's you again. But when you're hot one day and you're zero the next, that's a pretty good indication. There's another old saying, if you're not getting it, someone else is. Is that a red flag too, would you say?
It can be. It depends on the circumstance of the people's relationship, how often they usually see each other, their level of commitment.
How do you know when it's time to leave your marriage? When you say, you know what, this is more than what I signed up for, and maybe it's time to hit the road.
Well, for everyone, it's really different. For some, it's when they fall out of love with their partner.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people say in very long marriages that things like that can ebb and flow, that they have 3 good years and then 3 bad years and then 2 good years. And that if you stick around long enough, the tides will turn. But for me, it was when I grew to hate myself. That was when I had to leave.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how does that happen? How do you start to hate yourself? Is it just you blame yourself for what's happening, or you blame yourself for staying in it so long? How do you, can you talk about that a little bit more?
Well, it really becomes all of that, mm-hmm. everything kind of just becomes a cycle of crummy life with a stranger, and it's going to go on, and you just keep feeling worse.
Yeah. You have an interesting talking point here, and that is 6 types of guys to avoid online. And you know, what came to me when I came across this was, I wonder if I'm one of them. Now I'm married now, but I was online there for a while, and I just wonder if I came across as one of the guys to avoid. So why don't you kind of tell us, what are the 6 types of guys to avoid online? I'm afraid to hear.
Well, I don't necessarily know if it's 6 types, but it's certain qualities.
Oh, okay.
People who only want to text you and not have a conversation or not want to meet, like they just kind of want a certain kind of energy and attention, but they don't really want to. It's not about you. It's about them feeling that they have somebody that they can reach out to, but that they don't necessarily want to connect with you.
Yeah.
when you see them online and their photos only show a part of their face.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they say that men are afraid women are going to be fat, and women are afraid that men don't have hair. So if you see a portion of a man's head, he may not have hair.
Yeah.
You know, or if you see a woman and you don't see anything past her neck.
Yeah.
She may be concerned that you would not like whatever is past her neck. So
yeah.
That's a part of it. And then there's always people who keep you hanging. Like
yeah.
They say, oh, let's talk tomorrow or let's something tomorrow. And then they disappear for a few days.
Yeah.
And then there's the opposite, which is someone who you meet and they bring you flowers on a first date.
Yeah.
And then they speak to you in superlatives that you're the best, you're the most beautiful.
Yeah.
And then the thing that usually makes me want to go to the ladies' room and not return is our children will be gorgeous.
Oh, yeah. All right. By contrast, what would be the qualities of a non-chaotic partner when you're with someone and you say to yourself, you know what? This guy is pretty stable. This guy is going to be okay. What would be those qualities?
Reliability, consistency, someone who says, I'll call you tomorrow evening. And they actually do.
Yeah, it actually happens. Wow.
Yes.
Yeah.
So though, you know, a reliability.
Reliability
that,
is your
key some
word.
That somebody is real, that you get to meet their friends, that you get to meet their family after a period of time, you know, that you maybe get to go visit where they live.
Right.
And, you know, they're not living with their parents at 45 years old or something like that.
Yeah. I got a question for you. Now, I was married relatively late in life. I was well into my 40s when I got married. And when I was online, some of the girls that I chatted with or talked to, I met later as friends. And when the dating aspect was off the table. And they told me that what they didn't like about me was I had never been married before. Is that a red flag for you? If you're looking at a guy who's well into his 40s, he's almost 50, and he's online, and it says that he's never been married, would that, you know, right away put them off the list?
In short, yes, but wait.
That was my problem.
But see, given our culture, I think it may have more to do with the quality of your experience, the quality of your relationships.
Yeah.
I'm currently with somebody now who had never been married, but had lived with someone for 10 years.
Oh, okay.
So I would kind of, you know, delve a little bit to kind of ask the two or three questions to help me understand kind of where somebody had been.
Yes. Yes.
You know, one of the other questions I ask people is, what's your relationship like with your mother?
Mm.
If somebody says, I talk to my mother once a week, or we don't speak at all. I was on a date once and I asked somebody that question about 3/4 of the way through the meal.
Yeah.
And as soon as I said that, he raised his hand to call over the waiter and said, can we have a check, please? And he looked me in the eye and he said, we're done here.
Really? Wow. Maybe it's because some guys are kind of paranoid about the constant psychological evaluations about how your relationship was with your mother. And, you know, it's kind of a fine line as a man to cross, because it, you know, too close isn't good. You know, nobody wants a mama's boy. But by the same token, you don't want somebody who kicked their mom to the curb. So,
right.
You know, you kind of have to, you know, I guess it's a case by case basis. But that reaction was pretty strong.
Yes.
Very strong. I'm going to talk about what you hope the book, the impact of the book has on the reader. And going through it, you call it a memoir. And I would certainly agree with that. And you describe in your book some pretty intimate situations, interactions, I'll call them. That could be, for me anyway, I would feel, I don't know, maybe nervous about that. Were you nervous about talking about some of those very personal interactions in your relationship?
Well, initially I was, and initially when I was writing it, I tried to structure it as a novel so that way it wouldn't seem so personal. But one of my writing mentors advised me. She said, it's your story and no one else can write it but you.
Right.
It's your truth, so go all the way.
Right, right. Well, I understand that. With that being said, with that component, like we talked about earlier, it does have humorous segments. It's got some ones where you would definitely would feel hurt by some of the situations that were described. The personal things, everything else involved. What impact would you hope that it has on a reader? And are you going for male or female audience? Do you think one or the other would appreciate it more?
Well, I thought women would like it more, but men seem to be enjoying it as well.
Yeah.
But my overall point of view for my readers is no matter how bad or disappointing a job, a date, or a relationship has been for the reader, I offer laughably worse scenarios to soothe their angst and boost their hope and save them from a few hilarious hells.
Yes. Well, you know, in my opinion, relationships are relationships, and we're all human beings. And I believe that anybody can relate to some of the things that happen in this book. It's not that hard as a man to put myself in some of the situations that you describe. Now, some of them are borderline what the Me Too generation is talking about, some of the ways that you were treated on dates and stuff. Is that a movement that you empathize with or that you can relate to, or that you've gotten behind as someone who isn't 21 in college right now? What's your perspective on this as it's, you know, evolved over the past 30 years?
Well, I think being a woman in the workforce the last few decades, or more than the last few decades, I mean, I think practically every woman I know has had experiences where bosses or coworkers or people in clubs have been inappropriate with them, have been extreme to them, have been violent with them.
Yes. Yes. I didn't realize it until the last couple of years talking to a lot of my female friends, how many of them came forth with some sort of a story. And I know that there's always a tendency to put it as, well, that's a, you know, a liberal issue, that's a conservative issue, but this is really about treating people right.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with boundaries and consent.
Yes.
And especially in the dating world, or I know of a lot of girls who would invite a guy to their dorm room.
Yeah.
And many guys think, well, I'm here, we're watching TV on your bed, that's consent.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I invited you here to watch TV, you know, as in many times is what the girl sees, and he may see something else. He may see a permission that's not there.
Yeah. That what you describe is exactly what I'm talking about. It's common sense. Now, maybe it's just me. I never had that issue. I always kind of knew where I stood. But today that seems to be such a complicated thing for some men to figure out. I don't know why. But I absolutely hear you on those points. Now the book, I'm going to say it again, is called Stand Up and Heartbreak, A Comic and a Sex Addict Walk into a Marriage. Now, it is available on Amazon. And again, the author's name, Arlene Schindler. Do you want to direct our listeners to a website or any of your social media to find out more about you or find out more about the book?
Sure. My website is my name, arleneschindler.com. I'm also Smunny Schindler on Twitter. And the book offers sex, lies, jokes, and pizza, something from all the vital food groups. So don't miss it.
That's good. Is it true that pizza is like sex? I mean, it's always good to some degree. Is that true?
Yes, and especially in various parts of the book.
Okay, very good. We have been talking to Arlene Schindler, the author of Stand Up and Heartbreak, A Comic and Sex Addict Walk into a Marriage. Thank you very much, Arlene, for being on the podcast. It's been very interesting and entertaining to listen to you.
Thank you very much.
Awesome. My name is Billy Dees, and I'm here for HO Press, Shorthouse Books, HumorOutcast.com. Hello, Donna Kavanaugh. Hope you're having a great day. Let me try that again. Thank you, everyone, for listening to our podcast today, and have a great day.